Welcome to the Side Hustle Project, a podcast where we explore the nitty-gritty details behind what it takes to start and grow a profitable side hustle. I'm your host, Ryan Robinson, and in this podcast, I'm bringing you interviews with entrepreneurs, best-selling authors, CEOs, investors, and people just like you who are building and profiting from interesting side hustles. In today's episode, we're talking to James Clear, the prolific blogger with an audience of more than 428,000 readers who get his weekly content on how to create better habits, make better decisions, and live better lives. James has an uncanny ability to combine his research into biology, neuroscience, psychology, and philosophy together in a way that's directly applicable to the business world. James is now the author of Atomic Habits, a book that came out yesterday, and I'm staring at my copy of it right now. I could not recommend Atomic Habits more highly, especially if you're looking for evidence-based self-improvement strategies that'll teach you how to make small changes with the goal of transforming your habits and delivering real impact in your life. James is also the creator of the Habits Academy. He's a weightlifter, a travel photographer who's shot in over 30 countries, and seriously, more. James is fascinating, he's impressive, and he's sharing so much with us in this interview. Today, James and I talk about how he got his start with blogging, a decision that eventually set him down the path of growing a seven-figure business, reaching over 428,000 subscribers and more than 5,700 students in his paid courses. We cover how to create a winning personal productivity system and routine that'll set you up for success, including how to pack your day with small wins and habits that'll incentivize you to continue delivering on your goals. We dive into James's personal writing process, the impact of small, thoughtful habits in his life, his best productivity tips, most important business advice, and seriously, so much more. As always, you can find everything we mentioned in today's episode in the show notes at ryrob.com/podcast. That's spelled ryrob.com/podcast. Let's get into today's interview with James Clear. James, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
I am so excited to talk to you today, particularly because the topic that we're speaking most about is habits. And that's something that is very near and dear to my heart. Although I would be remiss to not ask you my typical first question. So straight out the gates here, James, what book are you reading right now, or what's been your favorite recently?
I'm almost finished with The Blank Slate by Steven Pinker, which is a really long, like 500 plus page book. And it's been very interesting. It's all about the biology of human behavior and how we come into the world predisposed for certain actions and choices, and like when that does affect us and when it doesn't, and kind of that like tricky, slippery slope of how big of an impact do genes make and when. And anyway, I found it very interesting.
Yeah, that's a fascinating topic. Any conclusions that you've drawn, maybe pertaining to your own life?
Well, I'm kind of, so, you know, I've tried to read widely and read kind of both sides of this issue or topic. And I've come to a strange conclusion, which is that we simultaneously somehow underestimate the importance of genes and how we are like predisposed to certain things. I mean, any parent who has more than one child can tell you, you know, same environment, same parents, they try to do the best they can with each, but kids are different. You know, people just come into the world with different personalities and different strengths and weaknesses. So we, on the one hand, underestimate how big of an impact that makes. And at the same time, we seem to underestimate just how big of an impact your choices can have and how much you can shape yourself into what you want to be. It doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, anybody could become an elite athlete or elite musician or some brilliant academic professor or something like that. There are definitely limits, but the human brain and body is far more malleable than we give ourselves credit for. We often set our own limitations and ceilings on ourselves. And so I'm kind of wrestling with that because both of those things seem to be true. At the same time, we underestimate our ability to improve, and we also underestimate how much we are predisposed to act in certain ways.
This is a really interesting equation. I'm adding this book to my list as we speak. I'm taking notes over here. So I'm going to be reading this soon. I like this topic a lot.
Sure.
So James, where are you originally from?
I'm an Ohio boy. I was born and raised just outside Cincinnati in a town called Hamilton, Ohio, and lived there in the same house for my whole life until I went to college. My parents still live in that house. and went to school at Denison University in Granville, which is a small liberal arts school in Ohio. Went to grad school at Ohio State. I lived abroad for a little while in Scotland, and then lived in North Carolina, and recently moved back to Columbus, which I think is the best city in Ohio. Yeah, I'm really excited to be here.
I like it. I love it. The Midwest has a lot to offer.
Yeah, it's great. I like North Carolina or New York, San Francisco, LA, and visit, you know, those places often for work and just to see friends as well. But it's a really good, like, Columbus is my speed. It gives me the space I need to like train and write, and there are also just really great people here too. So it's been good.
All right. Well, James, let's talk about what you're up to right now. So many people listening here today are probably most familiar with you from your blog, jamesclear.com. You're someone that I actually really look up to when it comes to producing incredibly in-depth, you know, well-researched, thoughtful content on the topics that you care about, right? So things like habits, thinking, performance, health, photography. But rewinding the clock a little bit, when did you actually start blogging and kind of find an interest in sharing your thoughts online?
Oh, well, thank you. I really appreciate that. I'm glad you're enjoying the articles and the work that I'm putting out. I've been an entrepreneur for 8 years now. I started my first kind of like online ventures with, you know, iPhone apps or websites and stuff like that around 2010. The first 2 years, is pretty standard entrepreneur story. Tried a bunch of different stuff. A lot of it didn't work. I was kind of fumbling around trying to figure out what skills I needed to learn. And so looking back now, I refer to that as the period where I incubated my skill set. And then November 12, 2012 was the first day that I published an article on jamesclear.com. And I decided that I was going to do that every Monday and every Thursday. And I stuck to that publishing schedule for the first 3 years. And that was what it was, really that writing habit that transformed my business and also just led me down this path towards writing about habits. It was through practicing it as a writer and in the gym and in other areas of life that I kind of felt like I had enough experience to go with the science and research that I was looking at that helped me maybe color the articles a little bit more. So it was November of 2012 was kind of when I really started in earnest on jamesclear.com.
Man, and 2 days a week is a really ambitious starting point. How did you land on that number? And this I know is kind of something that's going to dovetail into what we're talking about today, habits, right? Why twice a week? Was it an arbitrary time?
Well, I don't think there's anything magical about twice a week versus say three times or once or, you know, once every 2 weeks or anything like that. For anybody listening, I think the most important thing is to pick a pace that you can sustain, that you can stick with over the long run. But to answer your question, for my particular circumstance, I was doing it full time. I knew that there was a limit on how many good articles I could write. For me to write a good article, it takes 10 to 20 hours usually. 8 hours is kind of the absolute minimum. And sometimes for the really long ones, it'll take 30 or 40. And so I just couldn't, you know, if it took me 20 hours for two pieces, like that's a full week right there. So I couldn't do more than two a week. And I knew that I didn't want to sacrifice the quality. And so I focused on that. And I said, if I do the best I can on each article, then I'll have 8 or 9 at the end of each month. And 2 or 3 of those will be decent. I don't know which 2 or 3 it'll be, but I know that if I try my hardest on each one, then I'll have those. And my theory was, and it did end up working out this way, was that if I have 2 or 3 good pieces of content at the end of each month, then the marketing will be way easier because I'll have stuff that people actually want to read. And so I just kind of poured myself into trying to do the best I could with that content and then see where it goes from there.
Yeah. And I actually really want to highlight what you just said for everyone listening today is that, you know, I focused on publishing a level of content that was, you know, first of all, realistic, but stuff that I could pour my heart into, because when you publish something that's truly great, people want to read it. They want to share it actually, which I think kind of trumps even the fact that they want to read it, but that they want to share it with everyone that they know. And that's
true for any business, yeah. Right? I mean, you don't have to really convince people to use Amazon because it's so great to use that people the marketing happens for them. So I think you can say that's true for writing or really anybody that's creating something. You want to build a product that is so good that people are naturally drawn to it. And then you'll find that when you add some fuel to the fire and do some marketing work and try to spread it around and share it with people, it's so much easier because you've actually created something of quality. I don't think this is even more important now because the internet's become increasingly competitive as more and more people come online and more people are creating work. It's the cost of entry to make something great. And then once you've made something great, then you have to do the business stuff and, you know, make sure you share it and market it and so on. But I really feel like that's the essential ingredient. If you haven't done that, you're kind of still stuck in neutral.
Did you have a specific goal in mind that you were working towards when you started your blog?
I don't know that I had specific goals. I can tell you some general things that I kind of wanted. Like, I wanted to be full-time. I wanted to have control of my time. I wanted to have the freedom to like investigate ideas that I found interesting to me or to share things that I felt like were useful. I ultimately, my goal was just to try to help people or to share something that people felt like was valuable, right? And I don't really think that's unique to me or unique to most people. We all want to do work that's meaningful or that matters in some way. So I wanted that feeling. I wanted control over my time and what I was going to focus on. I kind of have a brain where I like to jump around and investigate a bunch of different topics. So I wanted a little bit of latitude and freedom in what I was going to be sharing or looking at. And then I did have a number in the beginning, which just, you know, things change, seems so funny now. But I really thought if I could get 10,000 email subscribers, that would have been like a thing. That it was like, okay, then I'll have, I don't know if I would have thought like I'll have made it, but that was the number that I had in my mind where it was like, okay, then I'll be serious. I ended up hitting that number pretty quickly, pretty quickly after I launched jamesker.com. But remember, I had like toiled away for 2 years before that. So I at least had some skills by the time I was starting this new site. But anyway, that was the number that I had in mind when I got going.
Did you have a clear path to hitting any certain revenue goals from your blog? So did you know that you were going to launch a course? Did you know that you were going to be an affiliate? What was sort of the rough game plan?
No, this probably makes me sound like a terrible business person, but honestly, I just have never been that motivated by money. It's not my one goal with money. I don't want to worry about it. That's like my metric. I've never been that concerned with maximizing revenue. In fact, I say this to our team, and I have this on the site somewhere, that most of the decisions I make, I run through the filter of mission first, not revenue first. So I would rather just do it so that it can reach. I try to optimize for reach rather than revenue. Like, how can I reach or impact the most amount of people? And then from there, you just kind of assume that if you're helping people and providing value, good things are going to happen. Now it's not quite that simple. You do have to have some business sense, and like, you know, we do have a course on habits, and I do have a book on habits, and I do speaking and things like that. So it's not like it's entirely outside of my psyche or that I'm not really thinking about at all. But it certainly doesn't lead the way for me. I'd much rather. I sometimes try to remind myself of this little thought experiment where I was like, okay, if I'm 80 or 90 years old and I'm on my deathbed. And I don't have any money in my account. I have like $1 left, but I was able to reach millions of people. Would I rather have that, or would I rather have millions of dollars and not have reached anybody? And I think I would far prefer the first scenario. I'm cool as long as I don't have to worry about money on a day-to-day basis. And I'd rather focus on reach and impact.
I like that. I think a lot of people can identify with that, to be honest with you.
Yeah. I don't think it's super unique to me. We all want meaning and impact and to feel like we're producing something of value. And I'm just trying to find a way where I can spend a larger and larger percentage of my time on those type of tasks.
So James, in my mind, you are someone that I consider to be a master of productivity. Your guides around those topics are seriously impressive, and we'll link to some of them in the show notes so that everyone can check them out. But you know, we're here today to talk primarily about your book that's launching, Atomic Habits. So why did you feel the need to write this book? Why did it have to come out of your head and onto paper?
Yeah, well, thank you. I certainly don't consider myself a master of productivity. I've always thought I'm kind of like in the arena wrestling with these topics like everybody else. And I hope that that makes the ideas valuable, you know, that I like have to put them into practice myself too, rather than just kind of sitting in the ivory tower and writing about it or sharing an opinion. But Atomic Habits is the culmination of 5 years of research and writing on habits and productivity and what it means to build a system where good habits naturally and effortlessly result rather than trying to kind of force it with willpower or grit or whatever. And your question was why this book or why did I write about it? And the answer is that habits are central to pretty much any endeavor that matters in life. We all have habits. We do things automatically each day. That, you know, depending on what research study you look at, between 40 to 50% of your behaviors each day are habitual or automatic. You kind of do them without even thinking about it. But the true impact of your habits is even greater than that, because often those choices that you make 40 or 50% of the time, they end up shaping what you do with the rest of your time. You know, like a simple habit, like pulling your phone out of your pocket. I mean, we do this so automatically and so mindlessly. You can be in line, you have to wait for 5 seconds and you pull your phone out. And that choice is non-conscious, more or less, mostly automatic. But what you do for the next 10 or 20 minutes, answering emails or checking social media or playing a video game, all of that is shaped by that one little automatic choice. And so you can see this all throughout your day. There are these moments where, you know, you decide to turn on Netflix or not, or you decide to check ESPN or not, or browse social media, or open up a document and do something productive, like write the next article. And those little habits, those key moments, those decisive moments, which is the language I like to use for them, they end up shaping the bulk of your day. And so that's why they're important on a daily basis. But the impact of this ends up getting compounded over time. And so good habits make time your ally and bad habits make time your enemy. So it's kind of this like habits are a double-edged sword. You want them to be working for you rather than against you. And all of us have experienced this where these small choices, things that you do each day, like eating, you know, slightly more calories or eating slightly less or deciding to meditate for 10 minutes or skipping it and browsing the internet instead. Like these are choices that seem insignificant in the moment. But it's only when they compound over a year or 2 years or 5 years or 10 years that you look back and you see the true power and impact of those choices when you are 50 pounds overweight rather than being the weight that you want to be, or when you feel stressed from the frustrations that have compounded day in and day out rather than at peace because you've been meditating consistently, or when you feel scattered and unfocused because your productivity habits are kind of off the wall, rather than keeping things under control each day. And so these choices seem very minor, but they actually end up shaping your life in a very meaningful way. And as soon as I realized how big of an impact they play, that was when I was like, well, I have to write more about this. And as I wrote more about it, people in the audience seemed to like that. And then eventually, you know, after 5 years of research or so, I've got a full book.
I really love this topic too. And I want to actually touch on a couple of the examples that you just used a few minutes ago. You know, speaking about deciding to open Netflix in a new tab instead of, you know, working on an article that's due. Taking that kind of example. So let's say that, you know, the people listening here today are on the same page, right? Like they want to be more productive with their time. They don't want to spend hours of their day wasted away on Netflix, playing video games. They want to be more productive, right? So what can you do in that moment where you realize, oh crap, I'm starting to slip and I'm beginning to waste time? What do you do, or what are some, you know, some tricks, some tips, advice that you would give someone who identifies when they're in that moment when they can go one direction or the other to steer themselves towards the habit or, you know, cultivating the habit that they know they should be?
Well, if you do actually notice yourself doing it in the moment, and most people don't, I'll come back to that in a second. But if you do notice yourself feeling that way, then a simple thing that you can do is imagine the future outcome. So pretty much every behavior produces multiple outcomes across time. You know, you walk into your kitchen, you see a plate of cookies and you decide to eat a cookie. Well, the immediate outcome that it produces is it tastes good. You feel satisfied. It reduces your hunger. You get a hit of sugar and salt and fat and so on. So the immediate outcome is good. The ultimate outcome, if you continue to eat cookies each day, is that you gain weight and you feel lethargic and sluggish and so on. And so the immediate outcome is good. The ultimate outcome is bad. And for most bad habits or things that we categorize as bad habits, that's kind of how it is. You smoke a cigarette and you feel relaxed. You get a hit of nicotine. Immediate outcome is good. You smoke cigarettes for 20 years and you get lung cancer. The ultimate outcome is very bad. Good habits are the reverse. The immediate outcome is often painful. You know, it kind of stinks to go to the gym. It requires effort. You sweat. It's hard. But the ultimate outcome, you're fit 30 days from now or a year from now or so on, is good. And so in the moment, your brain is wired, evolutionarily speaking, we're wired to prefer immediate outcomes, which makes sense. If you were, you know, deciding between going to the berry patch today and getting some food or waiting and going tomorrow, well, you don't know if the berries will be there tomorrow. So it makes sense to prioritize the immediate outcome. But you can already see how that doesn't work well for us in modern society because we're always prioritizing the immediate thing. I'd rather watch Netflix than work on a project. I'd rather eat a cookie than go to the gym. Then you end up falling victim to instant gratification and your results in the long term are very poor. So if you do catch yourself feeling that way, then you can state the ultimate outcome that is going to come from that behavior. So you can literally say out loud, you could say like, I want to eat a cookie right now, but if I eat a cookie, then I'm going to gain weight if I repeat this habit each day, and that's not the ultimate outcome that I want. And it sounds kind of silly to say that to yourself in the moment, but just by stating it, you kind of remove some of the power for that that decision has over you, because you're starting to weigh the ultimate outcome in the immediate moment. You're starting to make it more of like a now versus now problem. You know, am I becoming the type of person I want to be, or am I falling victim to something I don't want? So that's one thing you can do if you do notice yourself doing it. The problem with most habits, though, is that they're fairly automatic once they're ingrained. And so for many bad habits, people don't notice they're doing the thing they shouldn't do until it's almost already over. So a lot of the most effective strategies come beforehand or earlier in the cycle, which we can talk about that as well.
Yeah, that's exactly what I want to talk about. Please continue.
So the way that I like to lay out a habit is that it has approximately four stages. The first stage is your brain perceives something. So we'll call this the cue, is the common language in habit science. So the cue is usually an external stimulus, like seeing cookies on the counter, but it could also be internal. You know, like nobody necessarily has to tell you that you're hungry for you to feel hungry. You've got different feedback loops in your body and chemicals and so on that just kind of spark the feeling of hunger. So you've got some kind of cue, and then that cue leads to a craving, which is really a prediction about whether or not you would be better off in a different state. So you see the cookies on the counter, and then your brain, this is all happening within milliseconds, of course, but your brain is predicting, am I hungry right now? Would I be better if I ate that cookie or not? And you can imagine how your prediction would change based on the circumstances. If you had just eaten like 35 cookies, then at some point there's diminishing returns there and your brain's like, no, actually I would not be better off if I ate another cookie. I feel full, right? I'm good. So the craving is what drives you to take an action. And then there's the response. That's the third part. So you eat the cookie and then there's some kind of reward or benefit that follows the result. So the cycle runs all the time, all day long, this is happening. I mean, like as an example of how quickly it can happen, say you walk into a dark room, cue, room is dark. Craving, I want to be able to see. Response, I flip on the light switch. Reward, the room is now lit and I can see. And I mean, that happens in half a second, right? You don't even think about that. But that cycle is going on all day long. So as you get exposed to these different situations in life repeatedly, your brain learns to automate those responses. Anytime you come across a problem, or you see some kind of cue and you want to solve it, you want to change your state, then you automate that solution. So if it's a bad habit, then you pretty much have fallen into doing that over and over again already. So what you need to do is try to cut it off earlier in the cycle. And the most effective way to do this is to eliminate the cue. There's a story that I tell in the book about this woman who rode horses for many years, and she would smoke a cigarette with her friend each time they went horseback riding. And eventually she quit smoking. She also stopped riding horses for a while. And then like 10 years later, she hadn't smoked in many years. She gets on a horse and immediately has a craving for a cigarette because she had been conditioned to associate the response with that situation. And so one way for this example to stop smoking or to make it easier to stop smoking is stop riding horses. Stop putting yourself in the situation that that you've been conditioned to respond that way. And we can do this in many small ways in our daily environment. So I call this environment design, but you know, if you're trying to stop, if you're trying to lose weight and want to stop eating so much, then don't follow food blogs on Instagram, right? You constantly are being tempted with triggers like that. So that's one way to remove a cue. If you want to stop spending so much money on electronics, then don't subscribe to like tech newsletters and stuff like that. That's going to, you know, expose you to those cues. And then the same thing is true for our physical environment. You know, if you want to watch less TV, well, if you walk into pretty much any living room in America, where do all the couches and chairs face? They all look at the television. So that's what that room is designed to get you to do. So you can, there are a variety of steps you could take here, right? You can go depending on how extreme you want to get, but you could unplug the television and then only plug it in when you can say the name of the show that you want to watch out loud. So it kind of eliminates mindless browsing. You could take the remote and put it inside a dresser drawer and then put a book in its place. You could take the television and put it in a wall unit with like doors so that you don't see it as often. If you want to be really extreme, you could take the TV off the wall, unplug it, and put it in the closet, and then only take it out when you really want to watch something. And these are varying degrees here, but the point is, as you increase friction to do the behavior and reduce the exposure that you have to the cue, you increase the odds that you're going to avoid the bad habit without having to really think about it. If you're trying to resist temptation all the time, it's almost too late. You could do it. It's not that you can never do it. It's just that I wouldn't say you want to do that every day. One of the lines I like to use is, I've never seen someone consistently stick to a positive behavior in a negative environment. Even the strongest among us, you can overcome that for an hour or a day, maybe even a week. But if you're having to constantly resist temptation, it's just fatiguing and draining. And at some point, you're going to be tired and give in. So a lot of the most effective strategies for avoiding bad habits come down to environment design and restructuring that.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. I think the environment design component, so the exact example of, you know, taking the TV out and putting it in the closet or something, making it a larger barrier to getting to that behavior is the only way that I've learned to, you know, enact any sort of habit change. And another example for me too is like with snack foods. I love like candy, sugar, you know, cupcakes, cake, like you name it. If it's in my house, I'm gonna eat it. And so for me, the control is just not letting it in my house. That's pretty much the only way that I've learned to be able to deal with this at all.
Yeah. It's remarkable how, for as persistent as habits are, it's remarkable how quickly they can fade away, both good and bad habits, if you just increase a little bit of friction associated with it. Like for years, I flossed my teeth with the pre-made flossers. And then we bought a different brand one time and they were like really painful. They're almost like a wire. And so I stopped for like a week. And then I was like, wait, I haven't done this just because it was uncomfortable. And so then I bought the old brand that we usually use and then it was fine. It picked right back up. Same thing with, there was some device the other day, I can't remember what it was sitting in our house and it didn't have a battery in it. We use it all the time, but then we just like, we stopped using it because we were too lazy to put a AA battery in it. But there's just like a little bit of friction that was preventing. It was like, I'd have to go down to the basement to get a battery. And then, it wasn't worth it. So eventually I was like, well, this is ridiculous. We haven't used this thing in a week, so we're going to go ahead and fix it. But point being, you can do that for your bad habits as well. BJ Fogg, professor at Stanford, he has a great example. He calls it designing for laziness. And his point is he tries to restructure the environment so his lazy action, his default decision, is a better action. So like, I think the story is he liked eating popcorn, but he just didn't want to eat as much of it. So he took it out of his pantry, walked down the hallway, went into the garage, put it on the highest shelf in the garage. And if he really wants it, he can go get it. It's only 60 seconds away, but it's just enough friction that most of the time, if he's feeling lazy, he's not going to go do it.
That is brilliant. I love that. So James, one thing that, you know, you've mentioned quite a bit throughout this conversation, whether explicitly or implicitly, is that habits often ladder up to goals for people, right? So you set the habit of working out, you know, every day, every other day, with the goal of losing weight or getting more fit, building more muscle, right? You have some sort of goal in mind. And to me, habits and routines have always played a really big role in achieving goals. And one thing, though, that I have realized both with myself and with people I know is that one of the very easy pitfalls to sort of succumb to with setting habits is that you can create very, very lofty ambitions. You know, like, I'm going to work out for an hour every single day, 7 days a week, when I'm starting at, you know, I work out once a week. So what's kind of like the DNA of setting up habits that will help you actually achieve the goals you want versus sort of, you know, dumping you into maybe a cycle of getting down on yourself because you can't live up to the lofty goals you set?
Yeah, it was a great question. So I think, first of all, just as a general heuristic, even when people know they should start small, it's easy to start too big. Almost always, if you say something like, I know that I should start small on working out, so I'm just going to work out for 30 minutes. But actually, that's like way bigger than what it should have been. I'm going to put on my running shoes and step out the door. It should be something. So my general rule is, if it can't be done in less than 2 minutes, it's too big, especially at the beginning. And how do we define at the beginning? What do I mean when I say that? Well, what we're ultimately going for here is actually to adopt or to build a new identity. It doesn't mean you have to change everything about yourself, but you're trying to like refashion or upgrade or expand your identity in some way. And what I mean by that, and why I think that's so important, is that think about something that's part of your identity right now. Like for me, for example, I was an athlete in college. I love weightlifting. It's just part of who I am. I go to the gym 4 or 5 days a week. And I've been doing this for over a decade now. And it doesn't really feel like a sacrifice to me anymore. It's just part of my normal day. It's part of who I am. It's part of my identity. And that is a really powerful place to get to with any type of change, no matter what we're talking about, because once it is part of who you are, part of your self-image, the way that you view yourself, it no longer feels like behavior change. You're just acting like the type of person you already believe yourself to be. And so I think that in that way, identity change, true behavior change, is actually identity change. Because once you get to that point, you are that person that you had in mind when you started out. And the way, I think, to become that person, to fashion a new form of identity or to upgrade some portion of your identity, is that you need evidence. You need evidence to believe that in yourself. So if you could say that right now, let's say you haven't worked out in 5 years and you say, well, I'm the type of person who doesn't miss workouts. Well, at some level, your brain doesn't really believe that because you don't have evidence for it yet. And so in this way, each action that you take is kind of like a vote for the type of person that you want to become. And as you continue casting votes, you accumulate them. And so eventually, your goal is not to be perfect. Like, you don't need a unanimous vote to win the election. You just want to have the majority. And so it takes the pressure off a little bit. You don't have to achieve these things every single time, but you are looking to accumulate some evidence that that's the type of person I am. And so this completely shifts the conversation, because instead of saying something like, I want to work out for 30 minutes, or I want to work out what you said just a minute ago, I want to work out for an hour a day, 6 days a week, or whatever, it becomes less about that and more about, I want to be the type of person who doesn't miss workouts, or I want to, so putting on your shoes and getting out the door, that's, you're casting a vote for that identity. It's a very small bit of evidence, but it is adding to the pile. And so it allows you to do things, that mindset allows you to do things that are very small while still accumulating the evidence that you need to eventually get to the point where this is just who I am. And it becomes much, much easier to maintain that progress over the long run. So the key then becomes like making sure you select a good identity and making sure that you are continuing to do small things that cast votes for that. But I think that that's actually the more effective long-term angle to take than to pick a really ambitious goal and then push really hard for that and wrap it all up in the goal. And then even if you achieve it, there are disadvantages to that, because, you know, many people will say like, I have a goal of running a marathon, but then they run the marathon, they finish it and they stop running because the goal was not to become a runner. The goal is just to finish a marathon. And so once the marathon is done, they don't have anything pushing them forward anymore. It never really became like part of who they were. So anyway, I think that's the most effective approach.
Do you have any rules of thumb for sort of setting the length or the duration of what these individual votes should be in the early days? So, you know, mentioning putting on your shoes and just getting out the door as an example for starting from zero, if you want to build like a workout regimen or a running program or something like that. But, you know, when you're thinking about this in your own life, when you want to change a behavior, do you sort of say like, okay, what's the smallest possible change I could make? And then how do I have that or something like that? Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah. So sort of. So one, to just to adjust your question a little bit, I would say, what's the smallest possible change I could make that casts a vote for my desired identity? So that like exactly. moves me toward the type of person I want to be.
Exactly. And how do you apply that to multiple different disciplines?
Yeah, so I kind of have two things that I'll say are like good ways to start. There are many of these that I cover in the book, but I think there are two good things to start with scaling it down. So the first is, I call it the 2-minute rule. And I mentioned this earlier, the idea is it needs to fit within 2 minutes. So something that, and it can be even shorter than that, like clean the house becomes fold one pair of socks for the laundry or something like that. Or do yoga every day becomes take out my yoga mat. Or read 40 books a year becomes read one page each night. Like you need to scale it down so that it's only 2 minutes or less. And if it's that small, then I think it's small enough for you to actually make it a habit. And in many cases, this kind of ties back into our previous discussion about environment design. A lot of the time, it's actually more effective to build a habit around shaping the environment rather than worrying about the performance of the habit itself. So for example, let's take the example I just gave of, okay, I want to read 40 books a year or whatever. Okay, well, you could scale that down to say, I want to read just one page. Or you could make the habit be something like, when I make my bed in the morning, I will put a book on my pillow so that I can read it at night. And that actually is the whole habit, just to like prime the environment so that when you get in bed, the book is ready for you and you can just open it up and read a page. And you focus only on that portion of structuring the environment to be conducive to being the type of person that you want to be. And then you just sort of let the performance flow from there. And once you've done that for, say, you know, a couple months and you've mastered it and every day you're putting a book on your pillow, then you're like, okay, this is part of who I am. I'm the type of person that puts a book on my pillow each morning. So now I can focus a little bit more on the reading and maybe I take notes or maybe I track how many pages I read or something like that. So that's the first part, is the 2-minute rule. The second one is tracking. And this is not, tracking and measurement are about one of the most powerful tools you can use for building better habits, because they close the feedback loop on your behavior. You did something and then you get to see what you did by tracking it. Not everybody likes tracking, but it's incredibly powerful for awareness. So I'm not saying it's a tool everyone should use, but whenever I use it, I find that it increases my consistency with that particular behavior. So for example, you could track how many days you go to the gym each week, or you could track every time that you, say you just get a calendar. This is the most common way to do it. You just mark an X on the calendar for each day that you do it. But I have a friend who's a videographer. Every day that he does 30 minutes of video editing, he puts an X on the calendar. My dad goes swimming every morning. Every morning that he swims, he puts an X on the calendar. And then at the end of each month, he adds them up to see how many days he swam. You can do it for meditation. Every morning that you do 10 minutes of meditation, and so on. So you can pick whatever it is. My encouragement would be to combine those two strategies. So every morning that you do whatever that 2-minute rule is for the habit you're working on, then you go ahead and mark it off in the calendar. And then you can review how many days a week do I do it, or how many days a month, or whatever. And it's just a way of getting you invested in that process of building the habit. So I think those two strategies are a good place to start.
I love it. I'm going to be incorporating some of this myself too. So James, shifting gears a little bit now, aside obviously from selling a book, how does James Clear earn a living these days?
Yeah, we have five or six different revenue streams. So the book is one. The course, which is called the Habits Academy, is another. And for the course, we both have individuals who take it. So anyone who's interested in building better habits or learning how habits work. And then we also have companies that will take their staff and teams through it. So we offer corporate licenses for teams that want to discuss how to use behavior change and the science of habit formation in the work that they're doing, or how to build better habits among the staff. And then we have speaking. I do about one paid speaking gig a month or so. I would probably prefer to do a little bit less than that, but that's usually about where it ends up at. We have some affiliate revenue that we get through the site. I don't focus on that very much, but it is there, and the site gets a good amount of traffic now, so it can add up. And then, let's see, what did I say? Affiliates, books, courses, speaking, and we do some advertising as well. So those are the five.
All right. James, I want to ask you a few of my frequently asked questions as we come close to the end of our interview here. So I designed the questions to be intentionally short on my end. Your answers do not need to be equally so.
All right.
Do you have any particular strategies or pieces of advice that you'd give our listeners here today who want to start a side business and begin making meaningful progress with it outside of their day jobs?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, most people, and I've seen this many times with friends and family, it's really easy to get excited about a side business and the idea of it. You work hard on it for a weekend or whatever. But, I know we've just talked about habits for an hour, and I'm probably biased in this front, but it really is about building a habit around it. I mean, the only reason that I have a successful blog or have been able to build a business around this is because I wrote about it for, twice a week for 3 years. So it really is all about the consistency. So I guess my encouragement would be, think about the type of business that you want to build. So I have two things I'll say. From a higher level standpoint, start with, what do you want your typical day to look like? Like, how do you actually want to spend your time? Because, I mean, this sounds obvious, but any job they have, if you, for example, it could be really sexy to say, I want to be a filmmaker, but a lot of a filmmaker's time each day is setting up equipment, changing the tripod, changing the lens, adjusting lighting, measuring the lighting levels, editing video, looking at the screen, changing effects. And if that sounds like a good way to spend your day, or something you would enjoy, then that could be an awesome career for you. If you just want the result of like being a well-known filmmaker, but you don't have all that other stuff sounds like terrible, mind-numbing work, then that would be a bad fit. So I would say start with, how do you want to be spending your normal day, and then back into it from there. And then once you've done that and decided what area you're focusing on, then I would say the key is, every job has some repeated stuff that you need to be doing. Maybe it's sales calls that you need to be making. Maybe it's content that you need to be creating. But whatever it is, set a pace for that you can sustain. For me, it was 2 articles a week. For you, maybe it's 10 sales calls a day or 10 sales calls a week, or depends on the business. But the point is, focus on setting a pace that you can sustain, and then just stick to the schedule. Don't worry so much about the results. Like, in the beginning, I was not that concerned with whether the article, it didn't matter if I thought the article was good or bad, if the response to it was good or bad, if it was long or short. All that mattered was that I published an article every Monday and Thursday. The schedule was non-negotiable. Everything else that happened could be adjusted. And I think if you stick to that, you're going to learn a lot. And if you learn a lot, then you have an opportunity to get better at it.
I love that idea of making the schedule non-negotiable. It creates like a fixed routine. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
James, what's been the most difficult challenge that you've faced growing your business?
Well, if you were to have asked me this question early in my career, I would have like told you a story about something specific. I've had plenty of like catastrophes happen where I was going to make a presentation, the software failed, or was going to make a big sale, and then it fell through at the last minute, or stuff like that. But the longer that you go, the more you realize that one event will not make or break you. I used to think, oh, if I could just get featured in the New York Times, then I'd be set. But like, that's absolutely not true. The same thing is true for any disaster that happens in your business. Early on, I had my entire website meltdown, lost all the files, lost all the design, had to rebuild it from scratch. It was just a blip on the radar in the long run. It matters absolutely none at this point. 7 years later, 8 years later. So I think the actual biggest challenge is managing your own psychology and maintaining your health. All the daily stuff, the problems that you deal with in your business are not that big of a deal if you take care of yourself and work out consistently. For me, at least, working out consistently if I didn't go to the gym, I would not be an entrepreneur because I wouldn't have been able to handle the stress of and uncertainty of trying to figure all that stuff out. And then the second part is your mental health, being able to handle. Entrepreneurship is very weird compared to most jobs. I mean, the reason people like regular jobs is because they're fairly stable. Sometimes people will try to push back against that and say, well, if you get fired, then you lose your income. But what I mean is that it's not uncertain on a daily basis. You know what to expect. You know what your boss wants from you, generally speaking. You know what your role is in the organization. You have a fairly clear path to follow to be successful both in your role and to advance throughout the organization. The next step is always fairly clear. With entrepreneurship, the next step is never clear. You're the one deciding the direction. You're the one determining what to work on. And you have to develop this ability to constantly trust yourself that you'll figure it out. If I was going to summarize entrepreneurship in a sentence or the quality that entrepreneurs need, I would say it's that. The trust that you have the ability to figure it out. The willingness to figure out problems in the face of uncertainty. Because that, honestly, is just what every week is. So taking care of your health is probably the biggest thing. Because any individual thing will not make or break you, but you'll always be dealing with something.
Yeah, and that goes on to benefit things across all areas of your life, too, which is the most beautiful part.
Absolutely. I think entrepreneurship is probably the biggest self-improvement tool that I have had in my life. And I was not expecting that in the beginning. It forces you to decide what's important and what's not. You eat what you kill. So your skin is in the game and you have to figure out how to manage that. And at the end of the day, when you're the one making the decision, there's nobody else that you can't blame. I guess you could blame someone else. I'm sure there are plenty of delusional people that do that, but ultimately, you're the one that's on the hook. So if something isn't going well, if an employee is doing a bad job, you hired them. You're the one who's responsible for that. So it forces you to be very accountable to your mistakes too.
All right, James. Well, this is going to be my last question for you. What's been the best investment you feel you've ever made in the context of growing your business? And this could be in the form of time, money, tools, products, services, or otherwise?
I'll give you two. So, and they kind of go hand in hand. The first is investing in what I'll call assets rather than revenue. So there are many ways to drive revenue. And most people, when they start, they do it by consulting or speaking or freelancing or, things that they trade a service for money. But an asset is something that doesn't require you to trade time for money. It's something that can earn for you over and over again. So a product, a book, a piece of software. The thing about assets is they create leverage for you. They allow you to leverage your time. You can continue to get money out of the same hour, right? You can spend 1 hour writing an article or writing a chapter of a book. And that can continue to earn for you day after day, week after week, year after year. And so the hard part about that is in the beginning, it's really painful because all the gratification is delayed. You don't get paid till later. You don't get paid till after the book is written. Whereas when you do the graphic design work or the consulting work or whatever, you're paid right now for that hour. So you have to be willing to delay gratification. But once you've made it through kind of this valley of death in the beginning, and been able to sustain yourself enough with the products, well, then the money is coming in and suddenly you still have all your time left. And so you can create new assets and increase your margin of safety and develop an even better position. Or you can use that time to just hang out and work on something that's relaxing or exciting or fun to you. So investing in assets, I think, is a crucial piece of that. And then the second part of it that I was going to mention is learning how to be a good investor of your own money once you've earned it. Maximizing the power of compounding, whether it be investment in the market or learning how to invest in other businesses, it is just a huge, huge skill to have. And it doesn't, anybody who's taken advantage of it, everybody says the same thing. You should start earlier. Start saving earlier, start investing in your retirement accounts earlier, start investing in mutual funds earlier. All of that is, it's crucial, and it ends up, what it does is it buys you years of your life back on the back end. And the way that I like to think about it is the more that I'm investing now, I just keep eating like a year off of the retirement age until you're independently wealthy and you can decide to do whatever you want. So I would say that an investing mindset is probably the short answer, and doing that both with the assets and products you create and the investments that you put your money into.
Amazing advice to end on, James. Thank you for being here. Can you tell everyone listening today where they can go to learn more about you, Atomic Habits, and everything else that you're up to?
Sure. So jamesclear.com is the best place to check out the other work that I'm doing. And as you mentioned, Atomic Habits is my book all about tiny changes and how they lead to remarkable results and how to build a system where good habits naturally come through rather than trying to force it. And I think if you've enjoyed this conversation, you'll really find the book useful as well.
Beautiful. Well, James, thank you for being here.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks so much for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Side Hustle Project, I would love your support. Head on over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating. And as always, you can catch every episode of the Side Hustle Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.